all of this, including the reference customer, it's about understanding either what's in it for them, which you said before, or what's important for them to keep guarded or private or work around their discomfort. Like it is really a matter of getting them comfortable. It is a big ask to get somebody to vouch for you, period.
Hello, and welcome to the Misadventures in Marketing podcast presented by the American Marketing Association San Francisco chapter. I'm Steve Haney, a fractional CMO in Silicon Valley.
And I'm Peter Farrago, a high-tech executive in the Bay Area. Each week, Steve and I come together to discuss all things in marketing and high tech.
We share our own experiences running marketing and go-to-market teams with a special focus on technology startups. We talk about our successes, our failures, what worked, what didn't work. And we'll also be inviting our CMO friends and other marketing colleagues onto the show every once in a while and hopefully impart some wisdom along the way. So, Peter, how's it going?
It's going great. It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood here. I'm excited about our topic. The title I've given this, Reference Customers, the Real Growth Hack. If you work in marketing, especially B2B marketing, trying to convince companies to buy your products from other companies, it just turns out that the most valuable thing you can do, and probably the hardest thing you can do, and there's an art and science of doing it well, is getting another external party to vouch for you, third-party validation. When you go to a website today and you see the list of logos, they call that social proof. It is really about somebody willing to put their reputation on the line to stand up for you and say they trust you. That's very hard to get someone to do.
Obviously, it's critical because when you're a small company, tech company, that is, even if it's venture funded, there's always the fear from the customer that you're not going to be around tomorrow. And there are kind of two things around that early on in my career kind of blew me away. One of them was this notion of an escrow, companies having to put their source code on a physical medium and put that at some third-party trusted agency like a bank so that should the startup go away, the customers can go grab the source code off whatever it is, the CD-ROM, the hard drive, the flash drive. If they've made you a huge part of their infrastructure, then they're not going to be left out in the cold when the company goes under. And so that's one kind of level of credibility. I was at a startup and the VP of sales, and I needed to get customer references together. And this was for marketing materials. And the VP of sales said, well, you may want to talk to them really quick before they fully dive into the product and they're still excited about what we're doing with them. And that kind of shocked me. It's like, wow, okay, our head of sales isn't so confident about the product and that I would have to rush to get this reference and get their okay, because maybe once they dived into the product, they wouldn't be so happy. And you begin to find out that building a reference customer list can be quite perilous. You know, finding those happy customers and getting them to say good things. Now, if you got a great product, you're okay. But if not, you know, it's dodgy. You do want to build a list of folks, preferably global, because you want to have them from each continent, if you can, in each market, because you've got to build them. And then from each vertical you're in as well, just a critical part of the business's success. And then, of course, there's the outbound marketing stuff on the website, you know, the logos, et cetera, that you want to be able to display, and the quotes and the people. You have to have those individuals. You have to put a face to the company, to the customer, to the reference. It's just human nature. It increases the buy-in 1,000-fold when you've got that happy customer willing to show their face for you, so to speak.
So it's probably worth taking a step back to frame this just for a second, because I realize that reference customer might feel or seem like something slightly different to different people, depending on the kind of work they do. But at its core, the reference customer is typically a happy and satisfied customer who's willing to share their positive experiences with other people. The list that you're describing is kind of truly the asset. It's like a set of people you can go to for various things. Sometimes you're going to interview them and create a whole case study or success story. Right now, it's an asset that can be shared and distributed and posted on the site. And sometimes you even have them speak at a customer conference of yours. Yep. Or sometimes you have them be available to speak to the press on your behalf when you're doing a big announcement. Yep. So it is the reference customer is a person who's willing to do all those things. How do you try to extract that valuable kind of precious resource there? How do you use that reference customer? I'm not trying to be cryptic. I tend to try to get a case study out of them and a quote, because that is very reusable, right? And it takes a moment of their time, and then I don't have to keep tapping them on the shoulder, right?
I know we're talking a little bit about semantics here, but there are kind of case studies and customer success stories. And I don't know how you framed this stuff in your career, Peter, but I found that a proper case study is really hard and really long. And then you spend a lot of money doing it, and then it hits the lawyers, and the lawyers 50% of the time nix it. Customer success stories are they're much lighter. You still got the reference customer who is the champion and is behind you. But, you know, you're not asking for a proper case study, which I also align with kind of like the financials. You know, it is very targeted towards a type. We, at one company I was at, our developer tools were very deeply embedded in, believe it or not, a railway. And they were using our underlying platform for all these line of business applications. And that is what I consider a real hardcore case study, because that means another railway can pull down that case study and they have a blueprint for how they can make X product a success in their organization. It's almost like a recipe. Like, these guys did it, who are in your industry and were very successful. So here's the blueprint. Here's the recipe for you to do the same thing. This episode of Misadventures in Marketing is brought to you by the American Marketing Association, San Francisco. AMASF is a member-run organization that has been serving the Bay Area marketing community for over 80 years. Through programs, events, workshops, and discussions that introduce the latest trends and developments in the industry, to networking events that bring together the best marketing minds in the region, AMASF diligently works to foster professional learning and career advancement opportunities for all of its members. Joining is easy. To become a member of AMASF, go to amasf.org. That's amasf.org, and click on Get Involved on the top menu, then become a member. For just $199 a year, you'll get access to events, resources, credentialed learning opportunities, and a community of fellow marketers will help you expand your network and advance your career. The AMASF membership, the investment you make for the career you love. Customer success stories are way different, right? That's when you basically just got your champion saying, rah, 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 we love your product. So those are much easier to make happen because they're almost piecemeal. It's just easier to get through than doing what I've always referred to as a proper case study.
So everything you said makes sense, and I can give people a practical application. I am at a startup that fortunately has a very good product. The CEO is still selling, and he's able to get people to be willing to say, get interviewed for us. And the way I've handled it is what drove them to want to solve something or improve something? How did they discover us? How did they evaluate us? Did they compare us to something else? It's, you know, getting some of those finer details. Okay, then what it was like getting it going? What was the response? How is it working? How has it made a difference in their day-to-day work? So, and then of course we try to really pull out some hero stats. And it's kind of just an interview about their experience with us. Now, I've also found.
Can I just say quickly, the hero stats are a great point, and we should mention.
Oh, that's everything. Yeah, no, I mean, it's funny because, like, normally in my head, I'm asking them some before and after stat. I'm looking for a delta. I'm looking for a positive change. We went from X to Y. We saved this much time. We saved this much money. We got this efficiency. What metrics did they use? You know, all this stuff. And so I am looking to distill it down because the reader eventually is going to scan this. And to your point about having the right, I'll call it a case study in this case, the right story for the right prospect or opportunity you're talking to is very valuable. Right now, we sell primarily to developer tools companies. And so we're usually either talking to an engineering leader or right. we're talking to a support engineering leader. And some are smaller companies and some are larger companies. And so I'm like, okay, I need case studies for those situations. The other part that I'm finding emerging is we support a lot of open source projects, and that's yet another one. So I have a couple flavors, and I'm trying to, if I'm playing blackout bingo and I'm trying to think about, hey, I need to have story, you know, I don't need to have a railway story like you do, but if I need to have enough stories, six or eight covering most of these situations, what are they? You know, I actually talked to a cybersecurity company this morning. I talked to a large open source community company earlier this week. Before this, I talked to another kind of a big breakout emerging startup in the AI space that uses us. So I am actually figuring out, funnily enough, early, like how to even cover the various scenarios. Because all I'm really thinking about, like if I could break this down for everybody, and this is where you're going to make fun of me for trying to sound too intellectual, I'm trying to soften the N plus one sale. I'm trying to build that trust and credibility for the next customer going through the evaluation process with us and so on. Because to your point earlier, this really resonated with me and it's worth repeating, especially when you're a smaller tech company, large companies need to go through security and compliance and most importantly, know that you're going to be there in 3 to 5 years. They don't want to start building their business around a small company. They don't want to build on shifting sand. That's not good for them. So establishing trust when you're small is really important. It's always important, but it's especially useful early on. If you have a good product, people are willing to stand up for or about and say as much.
So getting these reference customers obviously is not free, but you've got to convince your boss and the other folks, especially the sales guys who are very, very protective of their customers, that we have to do this. And looking at this part of the process and the question, all I think about is how the sales folks are basically like, if you F up my relationship with Acme Corp, I'm going to F and kill you. I'm going to kill your family. People who owe you money, I'm going to kill them. People you owe money, I'm going to kill. Yeah. Don't you dare screw up my relationship with my multi-million dollar customer. And it's not always an easy sell.
Yeah, well, you're making me feel particularly fortunate right now. I have been in those situations where the salesperson needs to prioritize a conversation or an ask that is probably not what they want to spend time on, or I can use up some capital and also introduce you into their relationship.
You're right. Yeah. The capital that they've only got so many chits with their customer that they can do. So that's a brilliant point too.
Just to finish off that topic, how do you get the commitment or the agreement that this is worth investing in as a, call it a program? Hey guys, we need more reference. We need more customer case studies or success stories.
Right.
Which could be long lead, lots of asking, a lot of coordination, right? Back and forth approvals. How do you overcome some of the challenges you were talking about?
You know, it's just a process of trust building and the personal relationships you build within the company. Again, particularly with sales. I mean, I have never, ever been able to do this without interacting with the account exec on the account. Never in my experience. I mean, now really good salespeople completely get it. They completely get it.
Yes.
And they want you to do it, but they will keep a tight rein on your interactions. They want to sit in on the phone calls, which again, I think is completely, completely legitimate. You just have to build that trust over time.
All of this, including the reference customer, it's about understanding either what's in it for them, which you said before, or what's important for them to keep guarded or private or work around their discomfort. Like it is really a matter of getting them comfortable. It is a big ask to get somebody to vouch for you, period. It's like getting a letter of reference, right?
Yeah. And I think that notion of empathy, I know we've talked about this before with customers, is that does sum it up. What you want to avoid when you're going out on this journey of building a group of reference customers is understanding that they're a part of your community. The trap you want to avoid is saying they're a customer, they're giving me information that I am then going to go and validate, use to validate why other people like them or other companies like them should buy my product. And that to me is wrongheaded. It is not this transactional thing. It's like, no, you know, the way you approach it, your mindset is these people are part of Acme Corps family. They're in the circle, almost like when I was working for Apple decades ago, we had customer councils and they were leading big wigs that we would fly into Cupertino and they were part of the family, right? We were there to say, we empathize, we understand, you know, let's have our family meeting here, so to speak. And I think if you go into it with that mindset, they're part of your tribe and you need to look at them that way, then it becomes much more normal and organic.
The first thought I had was win-win, if it was a win-win. And sometimes there can be something in it for them, but sometimes you know how it is. Like if you just think about a product, a rare product, usually in our case, that actually impressed us, you know, or a company that just seems like it's doing it right. It's very hard to find those, right? It seems like they're reading my mind. They built the perfect thing. They're so attentive. Like if you do find that and you can be close to being that kind of company, super rare. Usually it's really just not that easy. Then hopefully by the time you're talking to someone, they are willing to talk to you. They want to help you out, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and in terms of also what they're going to get out of it, the reality is, you know, we've talked about this before, products we love so much, you know, the take my money meme. And people, customers, even in a B2B setting and a corporate setting, if they love your product so much and they love the company so much, they won't even look at it like, what am I going to get out of this, right? They want to be associated with a brand. They want to be associated with a culture. They want to be associated with a group of people. And this is why I get back to just, you know, be generous, be empathetic, bring them into the circle. This episode of Misadventures in Marketing is brought to you by Peakbound Studio, the Bay Area video production house for high impact marketing videos. Online video is quickly becoming the universal language of business and the primary medium through which marketers speak to their prospects. According to Forbes and market research firm Statista, 90% of all businesses are currently using online video in their marketing. And in 2025, 85% of those businesses will increase their spending in online video over last year. Enter Peakbound Studio. Peakbound Studio is not just another video production team. They are storytellers, visual artists, and high-tech experts rolled into one. They manage everything from the initial concept to final edit. Your online video presence has to be responsive, vibrant, and constant to get the attention of prospects and spread your message into every corner of the marketplace. Peakbound makes sure your messages are unique, compelling, and pop in today's attention-scarce world. So whether you need brand storytelling, customer testimonials, corporate videos, or short-form social media content, Peakbound delivers videos that don't just look good, they work. Learn more at www.peakbound.studio. That's www.peakbound.studio. Peakbound Studio, the video production house that puts your online video to work.
This is what makes startups exciting for guys like me. You know, we're creating this for the first time, and it's really fun to talk to people about their genuinely positive experience with our company and our product so far, and to get that first set of stories. But I also need critical mass, right? I need to have at least enough to then turn it into a web page or whatever. So that's where I'm at right now. I'm in that first sprint, but it's fun and it's part of the creation. And I've been here before and I'm trying to do it as efficiently as I can. I feel like it's maybe it's the nature of the work I've done or the types of companies I've been in. I've had to kind of repeat building out that stable a few times. At Flurry was a startup that was doing mobile application analytics for the mobile industry. And we basically powered most of the insights for all the major app developers in the first major phase of iOS and Android launching in this app store. And there's an app for that. We were in everything. We were able to be a strong thought leader that produced a lot of really interesting data insights. It did also get a lot of press. And I was also very heavily speaking.
Folks listening here may not know that your blog posts and the data and the analytics you exposed were a big deal. I mean, people.
Yeah,
would be
no, I mean it was
for your blog post.
It was an unnatural amount of press, honestly. And I've always tried to replicate it, and it's never been quite as good. I think it was a moment in time and a certain data set.
Oh, and Apple started blocking guys like you, right? I mean,
they didn't want
the analytics collected by a third party putting out.
Yeah, because of me specifically.
Yeah.
There's a whole story. But we were already kind of a thought leader sharing with this attitude of we want to share what's going on with the industry and be transparent and give people helpful insights so they could build better app businesses and, you know, get happier audiences and all that. Yeah. And meetups were quite big in the Bay Area. There's still meetups, but this is a bigger time, I suppose. And so I was starting to speak more at meetups and conferences that were already happening, Business Insider, VentureBeat, that kind of thing. Then we were having people come speak, and I had great relationships with the press. So I'd have maybe a tech reporter interview three people from notable companies. And so we were starting to build up a stable of relationships, you know, in a pure reference customer format, some of whom I could have talk to press. And then I started programming a lot of panels. Later, I even graduated to, I was on sort of a board for VentureBeat and some other places where I was actually programming some panels that they were doing at their conference, you know, helping them with certain tracks and relationships I had and saying, we should have that CEO speak. And so I just kind of kept graduating to the point where we got to this size where we could do our own first party flurry industry conference. We almost had Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, speak at our inaugural one. Our CEO knew him, and we were trying to, like, he had a private jet coming back from Asia, and we were trying to get him to land here to come here to surprise with a final keynote, but all this herding cats. But we built up such a set of relationships where we would be able to help people in their careers, as you said, getting them on panels, help get the right people together. And we were just starting to be seen as kind of a trustworthy hub business that could put people together and help gather insights. Flurry was probably the best reference customer, you know, sort of fully actualized experience. And so almost at every company, it's really just about being in contact with your customer base, right?
Yeah.
And letting them help you tell your story in their words from their point of view. If you can get to a point where you feel like you're working with colleagues outside your company, you're building real meaningful relationships with other people. That's kind of rare. And every time I get a chance to do it, and usually it starts with reference customer needs, it's just always really gratifying when it works out. And it's one of the things that, as I get older in my career, I remember people from 10 years ago, from 15 people, from 20 years ago, like you, we met 15, 20 years ago, right? I think we were sitting next to each other at some event. And these are the things that make a professional career way more than just a job.
Yeah, exactly. Good, good. I felt a little something in my tummy as well, Peter. So do you want to read us out?
Thanks to our audience for listening. And hopefully we'll continue to listen and share this with other people. If you're liking it, we would appreciate it. Thank you so much to our editor. The post-production work is a lot. Lorenzo Fernandez Kopeck at Peakbound Studios does a great job making us sound much, much better. Thank you to our marketing manager, Ian Robinson Lambert, for helping get the word out. Thank you to Ariana Azevedo for all the brand and the graphics work. Of course, as always, thanks to Eric Widener, the president of AMA San Francisco, for presenting and supporting this podcast.